So you might feel, incredibly well-informed about health. You track your steps, you're dialing in your protein intake. Maybe you even meditate every single morning to manage that chronic stress.
You're doing all the right things.
All the right things, but are you connecting the dots between those lingering, annoying gut symptoms, the bloating, the discomfort?
The unpredictable moods.
Exactly. Are you connecting those with the bigger systemic issues? We're talking about chronic, just unrelenting fatigue.
And that creeping, often debilitating anxiety that so many people feel.
And maybe most frustratingly, those stubborn metabolic problems, right? Like insulin resistance or just having trouble maintaining a healthy weight.
Because there is a single fundamental and a really upstream mechanism that increasingly links all of those things together.
And that's what we're here for today.
That's what we were diving into, dysbiosis. And this isn't some new fad word. It's a very precise biological concept.
Okay.
From the Greek, you have dys meaning bad or difficult, and symbiosis, living together.
Bad living together.
Essentially, yes. It describes fundamentally an ecological crisis that's happening inside of you, a profound disruption in the equilibrium, the diversity, and the function of your microbial communities,
Which then messes with everything else.
which then profoundly affects your physiology systemically.
Okay, so let's unpack this and set our mission for this deep dive. We have a massive stack of sources here,
We do.
and they cover the history, the mechanics, the global approaches, and the targeted solutions for dysbiosis. We're going to go back over a century to the birth of the modern theory.
And look at how this ecological crisis was first even conceptualized.
Yeah, and we'll even apply this modern lens to some really interesting historical case studies, looking at the suspected chronic illnesses of figures as far removed as King Alfred the Great in the 9th century
Wow.
and Charles Darwin in the 19th.
And then we're going to bring it right into the present day. We'll compare how different medical systems around the globe actually approach diagnosis. We'll contrast the sort of purely molecular, targeted precision of the U.S. commercial tests with the long-standing ecological traditions in Germany
And the officially graded system in Russia.
and the functional metabolism focus that's really favored in Japan. I mean, this comparison alone highlights some major philosophical divides in how we even measure health.
And finally, we're going to get intensely practical. Because if the problem is ecological imbalance, the solution has to be ecological reorganization.
It has to be.
So we'll look at the targeted solutions of what's called competitive exclusion using these sophisticated microbial tools or keystone species.
Things like Lactobacillus reuteri
The famous Lactobacillus rhamnosus GG.
and the unique transient yeast Saccharomyces boulardii.
Using them as therapeutic agents to restore that balance.
The core insight, I think, to carry through this entire deep dive is this: the relationship between you and your microbiota is not just, commensal, it's not neutral.
Right.
It is aggressively mutualistic. You depend on them for your survival.
I mean, that's a huge statement.
It is. Your bacteria provide metabolic functions you cannot do on your own. They synthesize essential vitamins like K and some B vitamins like B12. They literally educate your immune system about what's self and what's not.
And they produce neuroactive
A
compounds.
massive array of them. And get this, 95% of your body's serotonin, a key neurotransmitter for mood, is synthesized or regulated in the gut.
95%.
So dysbiosis is simply a departure from this exquisitely tuned, highly functional equilibrium. And as you're about to see, the consequences of that departure are truly, truly systemic.
Okay, let's start at the very beginning. I think it's important to acknowledge that before we even had the tools, the microscope, the culture dish, the DNA sequencer, to actually see a microbe,
Right.
traditional medicine had this ancient, almost profound foresight. They intuitively knew the gut was central to all health.
Absolutely. The idea that gut dysfunction led to systemic illness is, I mean, it's thousands of years old. Hippocrates, the father of Western medicine, famously claimed that death sits in the bowels.
There it is.
He understood that the quality of your internal environment, which is determined by digestion, basically dictated your quality of life and your susceptibility to disease.
And that intuition, it was echoed globally in ways that were much more systematic than just a pithy quote, right?
Well, precisely. I mean, consider Ayurveda, which conceptualized health problems arising from something called ama.
Ama.
Ama was seen as this toxic residue or a sticky toxin that resulted from incomplete digestion. and it would circulate through the body, causing disease and accumulating in weak tissues.
That sounds remarkably similar to modern theories.
It's striking how closely this ancient Indian concept mirrors the modern theory of toxic metabolites being absorbed from the gut.
Yeah.
And similarly, traditional Chinese medicine focused intensely on the spleen-stomach system. We saw it as the foundation of your postnatal, the energy you get from food and air. So if the spleen-stomach failed to transform and transport, the result was stagnation and dampness that led to systemic problems. All of these frameworks, without any microbiology, they still got it. They understood the systemic, toxic, and inflammatory consequences of intestinal dysfunction.
That deep intuition, it brings us right into the birth of the modern scientific theory. We're talking late 19th, early 20th century, and it really centers on one incredible figure.
Russian zoologist Elie Metchnikoff.
That's the one.
Yeah.
He won the Nobel Prize in 1908, but he's most remembered today for his gut work, which he developed while at the Pasteur Institute in Paris, no less.
Right. So Metchnikoff developed what he called the auto-intoxication theory. He was observing that the human large intestine was just teeming with bacteria that were essentially putrefying undigested protein.
Putrefying is such a visceral word.
It is. And this putrefaction produced specific toxic metabolites. We're talking about indoles, phenols, and ammonia.
Nasty stuff.
And Metchnikoff's hypothesis was that these toxins were being absorbed into the systemic circulation auto-intoxication, and that they contributed directly to the degenerative processes of aging and chronic disease.
It sounds a little reductive now, but at the time that must have been revolutionary, just recognizing that microbial output had systemic effects.
It was fundamentally prescient. He might have been wrong about the, you know, specific magnitude of the toxicity, but he was 100% correct in recognizing that the metabolic products of our gut bacteria were not inert.
Right.
They were pharmacologically active throughout the body. So his focus then shifted to, okay, how do we counteract this putrefaction? And that led him to investigate global longevity patterns.
And that's the famous Bulgarian connection.
Yes. Metchnikoff became fascinated by these reports of remarkable longevity among Bulgarian peasants. He attributed it directly to their high consumption of fermented milk products.
Okay.
And in isolating and identifying the specific organism responsible for that fermentation, he identified Lactobacillus bulgaricus.
And that identification was, I mean, that was effectively the moment the probiotic concept was invented, wasn't it?
Exactly. Metchnikoff's core insight was that these beneficial acid-producing bacteria, like the Lactobacillus species, could suppress the toxic putrefactive bacteria.
How?
By acidifying the local environment. It was essentially a form of competitive exclusion. This wasn't just observing bacteria. This was the first systematic proposal for modulating the gut microbiome for a therapeutic benefit, shifting the ecology from putrefactive to fermentative.
And this theory was taken incredibly seriously in the early 20th century. It led to this dramatic auto-intoxication era in medicine.
It did. Mm. And it merged Metchnikoff's science with this intense Victorian anxiety about, of all things, constipation.
It led to some pretty extreme practices, from what I understand.
Oh, absolutely. The concept that the colon was simply a reservoir of poisons was championed by prominent surgeons like Sir William Arbuthnot Lane.
Okay.
He became absolutely convinced that the colon was a vestigial organ that just accumulated these systemic poisons.
So what was the practical result of that belief?
Well, Lane took the theory to its extreme conclusion and performed radical colectomies.
Wait, he was removing the entire large intestine?
The entire large intestine. From patients suffering from chronic complaints like fatigue, headaches, vague GI distress. He saw it as the source of auto-intoxication.
Wow.
We look back now and recognize this as a drastic, often harmful procedure, but it just illustrates how intensely the scientific and medical communities took the systemic consequences of intestinal poisons.
They saw the connection even if their cure was a bit off.
They recognized the correlation between chronic illness and gut dysfunction, even if their proposed cure was ecologically devastating.
So this theory was highly influential. It shaped medical thought for decades. Why then did the entire field of intestinal ecology just vanish, what you call the great eclipse in the mid-20th century?
It was primarily driven by the colossal, undeniable success of the antibiotic revolution.
The miracle drugs.
They were miracle drugs. And they convinced medicine that the paradigm of one disease, one microbe, one drug was enough for all pathology.
Right.
If you could kill tuberculosis or syphilis, why bother with the complex, fuzzy ecology of the gut? The focus shifted entirely to single pathogen reductionism.
And all those functional complaints got reframed.
Precisely. Once the auto-intoxication theory fell out of favor, and it was probably over-rejected because of Lane's extreme practices, patients with those vague functional complaints like irritable bowel syndrome or chronic fatigue, they were increasingly told their problems were psychosomatic.
That's all in your head.
Exactly. It was attributed to neurosis, anxiety, or hysteria rather than genuine, measurable physiological dysfunction that was originating in the gut.
But the ecological theory came roaring back. And ironically, it was the failure of that single drug model that proved the necessity of the ecological approach.
Yes.
And that failure came in the form of Clostridium difficile colitis.
Absolutely. C. diff colitis provided the undeniable textbook model of iatrogenic dysbiosis. Dysbiosis.
Right.
Caused by medical intervention itself.
Right.
The antibiotics killed the targeted infection, but they also annihilated the beneficial competing organisms. They created a catastrophic ecological vacuum.
Which allowed C. diff to take over.
It allowed the ubiquitous spore-former C. difficile to expand uncontrollably, causing severe, sometimes life-threatening diarrhea.
And the cure that followed was the final, irrefutable proof of the ecological model, fecal microbiota transplantation, FMT.
Right. FMT success rates for refractory C. diff are staggering, often over 90%. I mean, think about that. No drug could touch that success rate.
And crucially, it wasn't killing the pathogen.
No, it wasn't killing it directly. It displaced it. It instantly restored a complete, diverse, and functional microbial community.
It was irrefutable evidence.
Irrefutable evidence that restoring the microbial ecology was more effective and more sustainable than any drug. It confirmed Metchnikoff's core premise. The community context matters more than the singular presence of a pathogen.
And this all converged with the rise of the hygiene hypothesis.
Exactly. Linking allergies and autoimmune diseases directly to reduced microbial exposure in developed countries. The pieces all started to fit together again.
Okay, that sets the stage perfectly. We now understand dysbiosis through several foundational models that all work together. Let's walk through the three main ones, starting with the most intuitive, the ecological competition model.
This model emphasizes that the healthy gut is a highly stable, diverse, self-regulating ecosystem, what ecologists would call a climax community.
Right.
And beneficial bacteria maintain health through constant competitive exclusion. They literally suppress pathogens by occupying all the available attachment sites on the mucosa. They leave no physical real estate for invaders.
And they starve them out, too.
They do. They consume all the limiting nutrients. They often produce enzymes that break down substrates so efficiently that potential pathobionts just can't get access to them. And furthermore, they actively fight back chemically. They modify the environment by producing fermentation products that create a highly acidic environment, which is hostile to acid-sensitive pathogens. And they secrete bacteriocins, highly specific antimicrobial peptides designed for chemical warfare against closely related competitors.
So dysbiosis happens when that competition breaks down.
Yes. When that tight competition is perturbed, it allows a pathogen to exploit an open ecological niche.
Then you have the metabolic model. And this is where the systemic consequences really become clear. It reframes the whole microbiota as a collective metabolic organ.
Right. An organ functioning outside of the host's own genetic coding. And their key output, the sort of currency of communication, is short-chain fatty acids, or SCFAs.
Butyrate, propionate, and acetate.
Specifically, butyrate is particularly critical. About 70% of the energy that your colonocytes, the cells lining your colon, need comes directly from butyrate produced by these bacteria.
And it's also anti-inflammatory.
Profoundly anti-inflammatory. It's an epigenetic regulator. It influences gene expression in your own cells.
So if you have dysbiosis and you lose those SCFA producers, the entire system just starts to degrade.
Exactly. The host cells lining the gut literally starve. That compromises epithelial integrity and promotes local inflammation.
And the other SCFAs?
Propionate and acetate, they get absorbed systemically. They travel to the liver, where they affect hepatic metabolism, glucose regulation, appetite control. So reduced SCFA output isn't just local GI trouble. It creates immediate systemic metabolic consequences.
And finally, the gut-brain axis model, which explains the anxiety, the mood issues, the brain fog that so often comes with GI problems.
This is the high-speed bidirectional communication highway between the gut and the central nervous system.
Bidirectional is the key word there.
It is. Communication is lightning fast via vagal afferents, direct neural signaling that runs from the gut up to the brain. But it also happens constantly through humoral factors, circulating microbial metabolites, hormones, immune signaling molecules.
So how does the microbiota directly affect the brain?
Well, by producing neurotransmitter precursors. We mentioned serotonin, but they also produce GABA, dopamine precursors, histamine.
The whole pharmacy.
Whole pharmacy. And dysbiosis alters this delicate neural signaling and metabolic supply chain. And the stress loop is reciprocal.
What do you mean?
Chronic psychological stress dramatically alters microbial ecology. It often promotes the proliferation of pathobionts through the release of stress hormones like catecholamines.
So stress makes the gut worse.
And a bad gut makes you feel more stressed and anxious.
Yeah.
It's a feedback loop of mutual dysregulation.
Okay. That foundational knowledge is absolutely essential. Now let's apply this new lens to some of those historical figures we mentioned, whose chronic illnesses have puzzled historians for centuries. Let's start with Alfred the Great, the King of Wessex in the 9th century.
Alfred was afflicted with a severe, chronic, and relapsing gastrointestinal illness that began in his early 20s. His condition caused agonizing pain, especially after meals, and it was debilitating. It often got much worse under stress.
And historians have guessed everything right. Crohn's, parasites, celiac.
Everything.
Yeah.
But the dysbiosis context makes perfect sense here because we can factor in his environment and his stress levels.
How so?
If Alfred carried a genetic susceptibility to inflammatory bowel disease, which involves a defective immune response to commensal bacteria, and you combine that with the immense psychological and physical stress of constantly defending his kingdom against relentless Viking attacks.
Right.
That is the absolute perfect formula for a dysbiosis-driven inflammatory disease.
Because the stress alters the gut.
We know psychological stress alters gut motility and permeability, which feeds the dysbiosis. Add to that the unique, parasite-rich, pre-modern microbiome, and you have fundamentally altered host-microbe dynamics. The relapsing, systemic, and painful nature of his illness is precisely what modern research would predict.
It puts a very modern spin on a medieval affliction. Okay, now let's turn to Charles Darwin. He suffered for decades from chronic nausea, persistent vomiting, profound debilitating fatigue, severe anxiety.
And even chronic skin problems like eczema and boils. All of this followed his famous Beagle voyage.
Darwin's case is one of the most exhaustively analyzed medical puzzles in history, isn't it?
It is. Proposed diagnoses range from chronic Chagas disease, which he likely contracted from a bug bite in Argentina, to a purely psychosomatic anxiety disorder.
But through the dysbiosis lens, those possibilities don't contradict each other.
They converge.
How does Chagas disease relate to dysbiosis?
If he had chronic Chagas, the parasite causes damage to the enteric nervous system, which disrupts intestinal motility.
So things just slow down.
It leads directly to intestinal stasis. Food and waste hang around for too long. And stasis is a massive promoter of small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, or SIBO, and large intestinal putrefaction. It essentially creates the exact kind of auto-intoxication dysbiosis that Metchnikoff would describe decades later.
So the parasite didn't just cause Chagas, it caused a secondary profound dysbiosis.
That is the hypothesis. Or, alternatively, even if anxiety was the primary issue, chronic stress hormones, catecholamines, are known to promote the proliferation of pathobionts.
So either way, you end up with dysbiosis.
In both scenarios, parasitic damage or chronic stress, you end up with chronic microbial dysregulation, putrefaction, and toxin absorption.
And that combination of GI distress, profound fatigue, and the skin symptoms.
That combination is almost a signature of systemic dysbiosis. The profound fatigue is likely driven by the chronic, low-grade systemic inflammation from the absorbed microbial toxins.
And the skin.
The combination of GI issues and cutaneous symptoms, the eczema, the boils, that strongly suggests a dysbiosis-driven skin-gut axis pathology. Intestinal dysbiosis produces systemic inflammation and altered immune regulation, which then manifests on the skin. Darwin's body was just locked in this vicious feedback loop between his nervous system, his immune system, and his altered gut ecosystem.
So, if dysbiosis is the ecological imbalance, what are the direct structural consequences of that? We have to zoom in now and talk about biofilms. This is a really crucial conceptual shift that is still, frankly, not fully integrated into standard clinical medicine.
That's a critical point.
The idea that planktonic, free-floating bacteria are actually the atypical, often stressed mode of microbial existence.
Right. In nature and in the human body, bacteria predominantly organize themselves into biofilms, these highly structured surface-attached communities.
Okay.
They live encased in an extracellular polymeric substance, an EPS matrix, which they make themselves. This matrix is complex. It's made up of polysaccharides, proteins, even strands of extracellular DNA.
So the gut is not just randomly colonized?
It is lined with structured biofilms. And the health of the host depends entirely on whether these structures are organized and mutualistic or chaotic and pathological.
And the pathological biofilm, in the context of chronic disease, it functions like a physical fortress.
It is the ultimate defense mechanism. It's why chronic infections are so difficult to treat. The dense EPS matrix creates a physical diffusion barrier that dramatically slows antibiotic penetration.
And this is crucial, right?
It's crucial. It means that bacteria deep inside that structure only experience subinhibitory levels of the drug.
And that subinhibitory exposure is the worst possible outcome for recurrence, isn't it?
It's disastrous.
Yeah.
That non-lethal exposure fails to sterilize the community, but it triggers a profound shift in the bacterial population. Some cells enter a dormant, slow metabolizing state. We call them persister cells.
And they just wait it out.
They're highly tolerant to antibiotics, and they survive the treatment entirely. Once the antibiotic course is finished, they regenerate the entire community. It's why we see chronic infection recurrence in conditions like chronic sinusitis, SIBO, or recurrent fungal infections like Candida.
In the gut specifically, this pathological shift means a loss of spatial organization relative to our own cells.
Exactly. In health, the dense inner mucus layer, which is constantly being secreted, is largely bacteria-free. It's a firewall.
Okay.
Pathological biofilms are defined by their penetration of this layer. That brings bacteria and their potent inflammatory components into direct inflammatory contact with that single layer of epithelial cells. We see this specifically in highly inflammatory states.
And what are the implicated species here?
A well-known culprit is adherent invasive E. coli, or AIEC. It forms biofilms that are tightly adhered to the epithelial cells in Crohn's disease patients.
Mm-hmm.
There's also growing evidence for Fusobacterium nucleatum being found specifically in biofilms associated with colorectal tumors.
And there's a fungal factor, too.
Don't forget the fungal factor. The yeast Candida albicans is notorious for forming highly resistant polymicrobial communities, often mixed with bacteria, creating biofilms that are particularly impenetrable.
So the moment those biofilms breach that final defense, they stress the next layer, the intestinal barrier, the one often called leaky gut.
And this epithelial barrier is arguably the most impressive and largest interface in the body. It's a single layer of cells covering about 32 square meters.
The size of a tennis court.
The size of a tennis court. And it has this incredible, almost paradoxical dual mandate. It has to absorb every essential nutrient you need while simultaneously excluding trillions of bacteria, undigested food, and highly toxic metabolic products like LPS.
And the critical structures regulating that boundary are the tight junctions.
The tight junctions, or TJs.
And we need to be clear that these aren't just inert seals. They're dynamic mechanisms.
They are highly dynamic molecular complexes. They're regulated by a complex network of internal signals, including the contractile actin-myosin ring. They regulate what we call paracellular permeability.
The passage of molecules between the cells.
Exactly. And when things go wrong due to inflammation, infection, or stress, the tight junctions disassemble, the paracellular space widens, and large macromolecules, bacterial fragments, and toxins are allowed to slip through.
And the molecule that acts as the master key to regulating this opening seems to be zonulin. This is a crucial piece of the puzzle.
What's truly fascinating here is the discovery story. Zonulin was discovered serendipitously while researchers were studying cholera toxin.
Okay.
They realized that cholera toxin worked by binding to host receptors and forcing the tight junctions open. But then they identified an endogenous signaling molecule in humans that did the exact same thing, zonulin.
So our own bodies make a key to open the gates.
We do. More technically, it's pre-haptoglobin 2. Zonulin is an endogenous gatekeeper protein that's released from epithelial cells, and it reversibly opens those tight junctions. Okay. Now, while this is a necessary physiological process, we need to pass some water and ions chronic. Excessive activation of this system leads to sustained hyperpermeability.
So what chronically triggers this excessive zonulin release, compromising the barrier?
The sources point to two monumental triggers. First, gliadin, which is the alcohol-soluble fraction of wheat gluten. Gliadin is a potent secretagogue. It triggers the epithelial cells to release zonulin. And this effect occurs in both celiac patients and, to a lesser but still significant extent, in genetically susceptible non-celiac individuals.
So even if you don't have celiac disease, eating gluten can transiently open the barrier via this specific molecular pathway.
That is precisely what the evidence suggests, mediated through zonulin release.
Wow. And the second major trigger?
Intestinal bacteria and their products. Bacterial overgrowth or dysbiosis, especially in the context of SIBO, means bacteria in inappropriate locations are chronically activating the zonulin pathway, leading to persistent hyperpermeability.
And of course, our modern lifestyles deliver chronic medication and dietary insults right to that fragile barrier.
Yes. The list is long. Non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, NSAIDs like ibuprofen, are among the most clearly established causes of increased permeability.
Why is that?
Partly because they inhibit protective prostaglandins that are needed for mucosal repair. Chronic alcohol consumption is directly toxic to the epithelial cells and promotes dysbiosis. And we can't ignore the ubiquitous processed food emulsifiers.
Carboxymethylcellulose, polysorbate 80.
Those. They've been shown in mechanistic and animal studies to chemically disrupt the protective mucus layer, which allows bacteria to get closer to the cell surface.
We circled back to the metabolic model earlier, and here's where that loop closes again. SCFA deficiency directly feeds barrier compromise.
It's a vicious cycle of structural failure. The loss of those butyrate-producing bacteria literally starves the clonocytes. They lose their primary energy source.
Okay.
When those cells are starved, they reduce the expression and assembly of tight junction proteins, directly increasing permeability. So the lack of SCFA metabolic support is a direct mechanism for barrier failure.
And this barrier failure sets the stage for the true crisis we need to discuss now, metabolic endotoxemia. This is the collision where dysbiosis and leaky gut lead to persistent systemic inflammation throughout the entire body.
This is arguably the most important scientific connection made in the last two decades. Barrier failure allows lipopolysaccharide, or LPS,
endotoxin,
the highly inflammatory endotoxin shed from the outer membranes of all gram-negative bacteria, which make up a massive portion of the gut biome, to translocate or leak from the gut lumen into the systemic circulation.
This is the critical collision.
It is.
And we define this clearly. This is not acute sepsis, which is a life-threatening massive infection.
Exactly. Sepsis involves very high acute levels of LPS, typically 500 or more picograms per milliliter. Metabolic endotoxemia is a chronic, persistent, low-grade exposure. We're talking 5 to 20 pgml.
But even at those low levels, it's enough to activate the immune system.
It's sufficient to chronically activate the host immune system through specific receptors.
Let's explain that receptor mechanism briefly. Why is LPS so inflammatory?
LPS is detected by a receptor called toll-like receptor 4, or TLR4. Think of TLR4 as the highly sensitive danger sensor for your innate immune system. TLR4's primary evolutionary job is to detect components of bacterial cell walls, signaling a massive bacterial attack. When low-dose LPS hits TLR4 receptors, which are on fat cells, liver cells, macrophages, endothelial cells across the body, the cell receives a distress signal, triggering a cascade of inflammatory signaling.
So chronic low-grade exposure to gut bacteria products is driving inflammation throughout the entire body. But for years, we thought it was just the high-fat diet itself that caused the metabolic inflammation.
That was the prevailing paradigm.
Yeah.
And the sources challenged that directly. The key causal evidence came from a landmark 2007 study by Cattini and Delzan.
What did they find?
They proved that infusing mice with low-dose LPS at levels consistent with what we see in metabolic endotoxemia fully reproduced metabolic dysfunction, the obesity, and the insulin resistance seen in mice fed high-fat diets.
That's a paradigm shift.
It was. It demonstrated that it wasn't necessarily the calories or the fat itself causing the inflammation, but the barrier dysfunction and resulting LPS leak caused by the high-fat diet that caused the metabolic disease. LPS is the driver.
That is a staggering implication. It suggests that fixing the gut barrier could be more foundational than just restricting diet in some cases.
Hmm.
So what's the full consequence cascade of this LPS-driven systemic inflammation?
We see clear links to the four great modern diseases. First, insulin resistance. When LPS activates TLR4 on fat cells and macrophages, it triggers inflammatory signaling pathways that directly interfere with and block the function of the insulin receptor.
The cells become deaf to insulin.
The fat cells and liver cells, effectively thinking they are under massive bacterial attack, shut down their primary metabolic function of responding to insulin. It's why type 2 diabetes is now recognized as a chronic inflammatory disorder that originates, in part, in the gut.
Second, the liver involvement.
Non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, NAFLD, is directly linked. Endotoxin drives hepatic inflammation by activating Kupffer cells, the liver's resident macrophages. This persistent activation triggers inflammatory cycles that progress simple fatty liver to the more dangerous steatohepatitis. or NASH.
Increasing the risk of cirrhosis and the cardiovascular risk.
Atherosclerosis. This is fundamentally an inflammatory process where lipids get trapped in the arterial wall. LPS contributes significantly to the entire process of plaque formation and instability by chronically activating the endothelium, the lining of your blood vessels, making them sticky, and recruiting immune cells into the arterial wall.
And finally, the neurological component, the brain fog.
That links back to neuroinflammation. LPS signals across the blood-brain barrier. And while the levels might be low, they are sufficient to activate microglia, the brain's resident immune cells.
So it's an immune reaction in the brain.
It is. And this microglial activation contributes directly to the feeling of brain fog and is now strongly implicated in the long-term risk for neurodegenerative disorders. It demonstrates that the health of your gut biome literally dictates the inflammatory state of your brain.
So if dysbiosis, barrier failure, and this resulting systemic endotoxemia are the mechanism linking all these disparate modern diseases, how do we actually measure the imbalance? This is where the cultural and philosophical divide in medicine becomes truly fascinating, especially with stool testing.
Historically, stool analysis was primitive. I mean, traditional culture methods missed the vast majority of gut organisms because most are strict anaerobes.
They die in oxygen.
They die in the presence of oxygen. The revival of gut ecology as a science only happened because of the rise of molecular diagnostics, moving us from culture to code.
And the American approach, which is heavily commercialized through panels like GIMAP, focuses intensely on quantitative PCR or qPCR.
Right. The U.S. approach is characterized by high technology and quantification.
Yeah.
qPCR provides absolute copy numbers for specific targets. Pathogens, virulence factors, pathobionts, and key commensals.
So it's very precise.
It's excellent for high sensitivity detection of specific threats, like the genes for C. difficile toxins, or identifying specific variants of H. pylori with high precision.
But if it's so technologically advanced, what are the major critiques of this targeted approach?
The critiques are ecological. First, it's targeted. You only detect what is on the panel. You miss the overall complexity and the true diversity of the community, which is essential for stability. Second, and this is crucial, qPCR detects DNA from both live and dead organisms. You can't distinguish between an active, viable threat that's currently producing toxins and just residual DNA waste.
That's a huge distinction.
It is. And finally, the interpretation often relies heavily on commercial reference ranges that lack the standardized, validated clinical correlation needed for universal acceptance in traditional pathology.
Now, contrast that with the German ecological tradition. They maintain their ecological perspective even during that great eclipse.
Germany has a robust tradition of holistic and functional medicine, Naturheilkunde. Their comprehensive stool analysis is highly integrated. It combines traditional culture, which is vital because it provides viability testing and lets you test for susceptibility to antibiotics or herbs.
So you know what will kill it?
You know, if it's alive and what it will respond to. And they combine that with microscopy and molecular methods.
And their interpretive focus isn't just on counting, it's on metabolic function.
Exactly. They approach the result through an ecological lens. They classify problems by metabolic output. Do you have a fermentation dysbiosis, an overgrowth of carbohydrate fermenting organisms causing gas and bloating?
Right.
Or do you have a putrefaction dysbiosis, an overgrowth of protein fermenters, resulting in high levels of ammonia, phenols, and foul-smelling stools, which echoes Metchnikoff?
They also assess those key functional markers we talked about earlier.
Yes. They prioritize markers that reflect the health of the host and the accessory organs. SCFA levels to assess metabolic capacity, calprotectin is a marker of inflammation, pancreatic elastase to check digestive capacity, and secretory IgA to measure mucosal immunity.
Their goal is different.
Their goal is restoration, which they call symbiosilenkung symbiosis control. It's a fundamentally different philosophical approach than narrow eradication.
Now let's look at the Russian system, which is entirely unique. They retained dysbacteriosis as an official, standardized, government-approved diagnosis.
Russian and post-Soviet medicine are the direct intellectual heirs of Metchnikoff's work. They never let the concept die.
So they grade it.
They retain dysbacteriosis as an official diagnosis, graded I through 5E by severity. Their laboratories perform incredibly detailed, high-volume quantitative culture. This means they provide a precise, systematic picture of the entire community.
More detail than just a species name.
So much more. They distinguish specific E. coli variants, hemolytic versus non-hemolytic, lactose negative versus positive, and precisely quantify beneficial flora like Bifidobacterium and Lactobacillus.
This sounds almost bureaucratic in its level of detail. Why is that quantification so crucial for them?
Because it leads directly to a highly targeted therapeutic approach that the West largely abandoned, bacteriophage therapy, phage therapy.
Right, using viruses to kill bacteria.
Exactly. That highly specific, detailed quantification of exactly which pathobionts are present and what quantity is essential because it allows them to select precisely targeted phages. These are viruses that kill only specific bacteria while sparing all the beneficial flora.
That is competitive exclusion with surgical precision.
It is. A bacteriophage is the ultimate precision tool. It only attacks its specific bacterial target. While the West focused on broad-spectrum antibiotics, Russia maintained and refined this highly targeted viral therapy for dysbiosis.
A completely different philosophy.
Using a natural biological agent to restore balance, rather than relying solely on a broad chemical agent.
Finally, we turn to the Japanese approach, which emphasizes functional metabolism, preventative health, and longevity.
The Japanese pioneer, Dr. Tomotari Mitsuoka, was instrumental here. He developed the concept of intestinal age based on the ratio of beneficial to harmful bacteria.
And their key contribution.
Similar to the Germans, but often deeper, is emphasizing metabolite analysis. They don't just count the species. They quantify the chemical output measuring SCFAs, polyamines, and detailed bile acid profiles.
So this analysis reveals the functional health of the ecosystem, not just a static resident list.
It's exactly. Knowing the functionality, the concentration of beneficial metabolites, is considered a much stronger indicator of systemic health and longevity than just knowing the relative abundance of a few marker species.
And this is culturally intuitive for them.
It is. The deep cultural use of fermented foods in Japan, miso, natto, tsukumono, means dietary modulation of the microbiome is a natural, intuitive strategy, not some radical pharmaceutical intervention. Their tests often guide subtle dietary shifts rather than immediate drug use.
This comparison of diagnostic approaches really highlights that the core principle across all effective systems is restoration, not sterilization.
Mm-hmm.
So given that dysbiosis is fundamentally an ecological imbalance, the most rational therapeutic strategy has to be competitive exclusion.
The logic is simple and ecological. If the imbalance creates a vacuum or allows harmful organisms to dominate, the only sustainable solution is displacement.
You fill the space with something better.
You introduce or support organisms that are superior competitors. This is the strategy that tries to avoid the high recurrence rate of the kill-only strategy of antibiotics, which just creates another vacuum ready to be filled by the next opportunist.
And we saw the ultimate competitive exclusion at the macro scale in the treatment of C. difficile.
FMT is the gold standard for competitive exclusion at scale. You are flooding the system with a complete, highly diverse, and functional community that instantly restores colonization resistance. The sheer force of numbers and function displaces the pathogen.
But for general dysbiosis, we use highly targeted, evidence-based single strains. Let's look at three key keystone species.
Yes.
Starting with Lactobacillus reuteri. Our sources describe it as an ancestral commensal. What makes it so unique in the modern context?
L. reuteri is a genuine ancestral symbiont. It was near universal in traditional human populations living in the upper GI tract, but it is now frequently absent in modern Western populations. Due to diet, high hygiene standards, and repeated antibiotic exposure throughout childhood, restoring it is seen as addressing a major evolutionary mismatch, reintroducing a critical partner we've lost.
And its signature weapon is reuterin. How does this work?
Reuterin is a potent, broad-spectrum antimicrobial compound. Crucially, L. reuteri produces reuterin from the metabolism of glycerol.
And it's like chemical warfare.
It is effective chemical warfare. It kills a diverse range of competing organisms, including problematic gram-negatives, various gram-positives, the fungal species Candida, and even some protozoa. This is the primary mechanism by which it executes competitive exclusion. It's a subtle but powerful way of clearing space for itself and other beneficials.
Beyond fighting pathogens, you mentioned systemic effects that link directly back to the gut-brain axis, specifically the oxytocin pathway. This sounds almost unbelievable.
It's remarkable science, particularly concerning strain ATCC-PTA6475, which was studied at MIT.
Yeah.
This strain was found to increase systemic oxytocin levels.
The love hormone.
Often called the love hormone, but it affects far more than social bonding. This happens via vagal nerve signaling. The bacteria's metabolites interact with the receptors on the vagus nerve, sending signals directly to the central nervous system.
What were the observable systemic effects of this oxytocin boost?
In animal models, the oxytocin increase linked the gut to systemic effects on skin health, improved healing, collagen production, as well as dampening the stress response and altering social behavior.
So this one organism is basically modulating the host's entire neuroendocrine system.
Moving us toward a more calm, resilient state, yes.
Clinically, where does L-reuteri really shine?
Strain DSM 118938 has the strongest evidence globally for reducing infantile colic, that excessive, unexplained crying in babies. This indication is now integrated into numerous clinical guidelines.
And there are metabolic effects, too.
Another highly specific example is strain NCIMB 30242, which has unique metabolic effects. It reduces LDL cholesterol levels, primarily through an enzyme called bile salt hydrolase. It demonstrates how strain-specific enzymes can drive systemic metabolic outcomes way outside of the gut itself.
Okay, next we have Lactobacillus rhamnosus GG. This is probably the most commonly known and certainly one of the most studied strains globally, the versatile immune architect.
GG is the reference standard for stability and colonization. Its core mechanism for competitive exclusion is not just chemical, it's physical. It's called pili-mediated adhesion.
Hully.
They're hair-like appendages that allow the bacteria to adhere tenaciously to the mucosal lining. This enables prolonged colonization, often detectable for up to 2 weeks after you stop taking it. This sustained physical presence provides highly stable, long-term competitive exclusion.
And its immune expertise is vast, particularly in early life.
It is a critical immune modulator. It excels at promoting regulatory T cells, or TREGs.
The pacekeepers.
They are the peacekeeping force of the immune system. They suppress excessive inflammatory and allergic responses, specifically downregulating the Th2 response, which is the primary driver behind many allergies and atopic conditions.
It also supports the physical barrier directly, separate from SCFA production.
That's its barrier cytoprotection mechanism. L-rhamnosus GG secretes specific soluble proteins known as P40 and P75. These proteins act as signaling molecules that protect the epithelial cells from programmed cell death and actively upregulate the production of tight junction proteins.
So it's telling the host cell, repair the barrier now.
Essentially, yes.
The clinical cornerstones are really clearly defined for GG.
Absolutely. The strongest evidence is for reducing acute pediatric diarrhea, both infectious and antibiotic associated.
And its immune role.
Its role as an immune architect is evidenced by the robust data showing it can reduce the incidence of eczema and atopic dermatitis by about 50% when given during the perinatal period, late pregnancy, and early infancy. It shows its power in training the infant immune system.
And it even works outside the gut.
Yes. Strain GR1 is used specifically because, when taken orally, it translocates and adheres to the urogenital epithelium, significantly reducing the recurrence of bacterial vaginosis, BV, and UTIs.
Finally, we have to discuss Saccharomyces boulardii. This is truly unique because it's in a completely different biological kingdom. It is a non-colonizing yeast.
Its identity as a eukaryote provides its primary therapeutic advantage. It is intrinsically resistant to antibacterial antibiotics.
Right.
Since the drugs are designed to target bacterial cellular structures, they simply do not affect the yeast. This makes it the ideal bridge therapy to use during antibiotic courses. It provides ecological support when the bacterial community is being devastated.
And its signature mechanism is immediate and protective, toxin neutralization.
This is its superstar ability in the context of C. diff prevention. S. boulardii produces a specific 54 kilovents serine protease enzyme. This protease directly cleaves and inactivates the massive toxins A and B produced by C. difficile.
So it protects you from the toxins, even if the bug is still there.
It provides immediate, tangible protection.
Yes. It also acts as a sophisticated ecological decoy.
Precisely. Its surface is rich in mannose-rich glycoproteins. Pathogens like E. coli, Vibrio cholerae, even the protozoan Giardia, use specific adhesins to stick to our mucosal cells.
But they stick to the yeast instead.
When S. boulardii is present, the pathogens bind to the yeast decoy instead. The yeast is transient, it's carried out of the body in the stool, and it takes the bound pathogens and their toxins with it. It's a highly effective, non-inflammatory clearance mechanism.
And it has trophic effects on our own cells, supporting recovery.
It secretes polyamines, spermine, and spermidine, which are essential molecules that accelerate epithelial maturation, proliferation, and the activity of digestive enzymes like lactase. So after the gut lining has been damaged, S. boulardii actively supports mucosal healing and the restoration of digestive function.
Its clinical role is pretty clear then.
In the prevention of antibiotic-associated diarrhea and C. diff recurrence, it remains unmatched. Hashtag tag out.
So if we synthesize everything we've covered, the story of chronic illness in the modern world is really unified by this central mechanism. Dysbiosis, fueled by modern diet and antibiotics, promotes these pathological biofilms and barrier compromise, which, in turn, creates metabolic endotoxemia.
And that is a single upstream driver for seemingly disparate conditions.
Right. Type 2 diabetes, heart disease, chronic fatigue, anxiety, neurodegeneration, all of it.
And the unifying task for health, then, is not a strategy of perpetual sterilization or chemical warfare. It's one of cultivation.
Right.
Creating the environmental conditions where these mutualistic communities can thrive and their beneficial outputs, like SCFAs, are maximized.
And L. reuteri, L. rhamnosus GG, and S. gallardii are sophisticated, evidence-based tools for initiating that ecological reorganization.
Each brings a unique set of mechanisms, whether it's chemical reuterin warfare, physical pili adhesion, or immediate toxin neutralization, to restore the delicate balance that we've lost.
Okay, here is a final provocative thought for you to consider as you wrap up this deep dive. We've seen how the failure of the intestinal barrier to filter signals, whether that signal is gliadin, NSAIDs, or the omnipresent LPS from our altered ecosystem, may be the single greatest factor driving the chronic disease burden of the modern world. If Alfred the Great and Charles Darwin suffered from what we now recognize as severe dysbiosis, what does that tell us about the foundational non-genetic weakness of the human host? And what other essential ancestral symbionts beyond the ones we discussed today are we missing? What else does our body desperately need for immune, metabolic, and neurological balance? Perhaps the future of medicine lies not in finding new drugs, but in restoring the mutualistic relationships we fractured.